Birds are such a wonder to watch, aren't they? And fun to listen to all year long. There are quite a few species that spend our long, cold Wisconsin winters here. And some, like the snowy owls, actually come from Canada to visit this time of the year. Some years, not every year, but many years. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. On this New Year's Day, we are celebrating our birds with a couple of guests for you. Carl Schwartz is the former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and is the editor of the Badger Birder, the society's monthly newsletter. He also serves on the Great Wisconsin Birdathon Committee of the Natural Resources Foundation. He's the chair of the steering committee for Bird City, Wisconsin. Carl, always a pleasure.
Larry, my pleasure as well. Great way to start the new year. Talking about birds.
You betcha. Tom Schultz with us as well. Tom's a well-known wildlife artist who's illustrated several field guides to birds. He served as the field trip leader for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, served for several years as a member of the steering committee of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project, lives in Green Lake. And Tom, thank you for joining us again today.
Well, thank you, Larry. Good morning to you, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Happy New Year to everybody. And I tell you what, as you're listening in on this first day of the year and you have a question, you can call in or maybe an experience to share about birds in your area. I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you have some bird photos of birds, certainly love to see them as well. You can post them up on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your photos and your questions or comments right there as well. Guys, we had a very cold November, and then until just the past few days, really, we had a very pretty mild December, at least in southern Wisconsin, but across a good part of the state. Very little snow in the south. Did any impact on our bird life? What do you think, Carl?
Well, I think birds in a number of areas are a little harder to find. They're a little more dispersed. That really cold early part of November that we had, I think drove some things that usually linger around into the Christmas count season south out of the state. And And then when it warmed up and the snow melted and everything, there was, a lot of food still around, and birds weren't compelled to come to the feeders or to the roadsides to grit and pick up weed seeds and stuff. They had plenty of food. So I think I was out this morning. I led a birding trip for the Noel J. Cutright Bird Club this morning, and we found things a little scattered and not as easy to find as you really like to start the New Year's. We didn't have quite as high a species count as we would have liked, but we still had a great time.
Yeah, you always have a good time. I did my little 5K, about 3.5 mile jog this morning, and I didn't see any birds. I mean, there are hardly any around in our neighborhood. And I thought, oh, that's kind of too bad.
Yeah. I mean, it's just that, when natural food sources, Tom has been out doing Christmas bird counts too. Maybe he has some experiences, but that's so far what I've seen. And certainly there are no field birds, the sorts of things that you'll often see, like snow buntings and Lapland longspurs and horned larks. Those, from what I can tell, were pretty scarce on most Christmas counts.
And yeah.
Those are some of the things people are used to seeing.
Well, Tom, I had seven adult turkeys on my front lawn a couple of days ago when it was still warm, drinking out of my bird bath.
That's
And I'm believe me, I'm right in Madison.
Yes. Yeah,
we
occasionally see turkeys here also, but we're in a rural setting between Green Lake and Princeton. And but I've kind of discouraged turkeys from coming to my feeders too much, just because they're prone to eat so much and probably scare some of the other birds away as well.
Yeah, Oh, you're absolutely right about that. You know, Mark in Mineral Point has a good question, I think. So let's go there. Mark, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I just wanted to get some advice on trying to find some snowy owls. I mean, I've been on the eBird map and, you know, looking at the checklist and so on for the different sightings, but I know it's, you know, it's probably hit and miss, but I'm just wondering what, you know, time of day and that kind of thing and the type of terrain. And I know they like open areas, or at least I've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you that Ryan Brady from the DNR just updated the map again. I just saw an email from him today. So, you know, there's something like 226 roughly snowy owls in the state right now. It's getting hard to tell duplicate sightings and everything. So Ryan says that's just a pretty good number, not a perfect number. And I know from personal experience and from things I've seen, the Horicon Marsh area, the Goose Pond area over in Columbia County, those are particularly good areas. The area up around Freedom, Wisconsin, those fields up there are usually pretty good spots. But you're right, it's not easy. It takes patience and some luck to see these birds.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Marty in Pulsifer, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
I live on the river, and I have river frontage. But I think one of the most beautiful sights that I see in the summertime, not right now, is the osprey will come and catch a fish, and the eagle will chase it until it drops the fish, and then the eagle will go for the fish. and that is just an awesome, awesome sight to see. But I also have snow owls there this year. That is just an absolutely most beautiful bird that
right.
is just around.
Where are you?
Pardon?
What river are you on?
I'm on the Oconto River.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that's you point up a good example of one thing we learned is that ospreys are better fishers than eagles, and eagles are bigger and meaner. I shouldn't say meaner, but they're aggressive, and they'll look to grab a free meal rather than work for one when they can.
Yeah. Tom, you had recently had an interesting experience with a kestrel and a Cooper's hawk.
Yeah, that was on the Fond du Lac Christmas bird count, which took place a week and a half ago on the Saturday 20th, I guess that was. Anyway, I was watching a kestrel. It flew up off of a road sign carrying, I couldn't tell for sure if it was a mouse or a small bird, but it took off and started flying to the right and went over a little hill next to the road, and all of a sudden there was a Cooper's hawk that was obviously intentively watching the kestrel and appeared to be chasing it. So I quick backed up the car to see if I could get a better vantage point, and then all of a sudden here comes the reverse. The Cooper's hawk was flying left being chased by the kestrel. So I couldn't tell for sure if he was carrying something, but I expect that he likely stole whatever the kestrel had and was taking it for himself. So it was an interesting sighting. The Cooper's is probably about close to double the size of the kestrel, so he can have his way with a kestrel if he wants to.
There you go. Oh, man. Matt in Madison, let's go to you next. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Carl. Hi, Tom.
Morning.
Happy New Year.
Hi, Matt. Happy New Year.
Yeah, I just heard Goose Pond, and, you know, I work with Madison Audubon Society, so I had a way in on the snowies that we've seen out there. And it's really exciting because we've had three snowies already out by Goose Pond that are really easy, quite easy to find. And, you know, simple locations are located on Highway K and Highway I, and that I don't know, maybe 100 people out there already finding them and snapping photos of them. But what, one thing that's really exciting that I wanted to just mention was that there's a project called Project Snowstorm, which is this really interesting project that was started following the eruption last year by some folks over in the Northeast United States, where they're tracking owls. And so they've got 22 owls online, including 4 from Wisconsin, one of them which was they were sponsored by Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and Natural Resource Foundation. And so they can track the owls online and find all sorts of information about them, about habitat use and where they're spending their time and their home ranges, and a lot of the data that we could not really get on this really cryptic, not cryptic, but hard to study species. So I'm just really excited because we're Madison Audubon Society is working hard to get another owl, one of the owls that's out of Goose Pond, with a collar, and get them online. So I was excited. I wanted to announce that and let everybody know about that.
That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, WSO, Tom also has served as a president of WSO, and in fact, he was my immediate predecessor, and my successor, Kim Kreidinger, was instrumental in getting WSO to sponsor not just one, but two. We finally ended up sponsoring 2 of these owls last year, and I'm looking forward very much to being able to publish an article in an upcoming issue of the Badger Birder on some of the results of that research and study, and I'm thrilled to hear that Madison Audubon, which is, you know, just one of the leading organizations in the state for conservation in general, but specifically for bird conservation, is getting behind this as well. That's wonderful news, Matt.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's a really exciting thing. It's such a wonderful species, and so I encourage everybody to go and try to see them, and of course, be respectful for people's property and the owls themselves. But really try to check these out. You'll be really struck how big the bird is. It's so striking, but it's also really big. So, so that's all I really want to say. I really appreciate you guys being on today. And Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, Matt. And I guess for our earlier caller, who was called from southern Wisconsin, Goose Pond would be the place to go then, I would think.
It's a great place to go. And we have updates on our Facebook page about where they're spending some time. Head on out there today. You'll probably be able to see one, take a picture, and see how amazing that bird is up close.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Happy New Year. That's wonderful. That's a wonderful story. Great news. John in Hebron, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. There's an area that's just north of Verona and south of Middleton, where Midtown Road meets County M, that's just loaded with hawks. And whenever I'm up there, I can always see 2 or 3. All of the streets are named after hawks, Hawk's Nest and Hawk's Ridge and Hawk Stones and that kind of thing. And that area has only been developed in the last couple of decades, so I'm assuming that it was loaded with hawks prior to that, but they don't seem to be deterred at all by the development. And it's hard to imagine that there's enough room for so many of them to nest and forage and that sort of thing. So I was just wondering why so many of them hang around that particular area.
Huh, interesting. Tom, do you want to take a crack first?
I'll give it a try, Larry. I'm not personally too familiar with that area, but I'm guessing that there must be some good grasslands in the area that hold rodent populations. A lot of the raptors that we see tend to be specialists on small rodents like meadow voles, and those voles will go through population cycles. You'll have peaks and lows, and then during the times when the population is high is when you tend to see the most raptors in an area, because they really take advantage of that resource.
Well, sure.
I don't know if there may be excipiters in that area also, if there happen to be more woodlands, and they're more specialized for flying through forested areas.
Yeah,
really adept at maneuverability.
That is true with species in general, but particularly raptors. If usually if there are a number of them around, it means there's a good prey base. And I mean, that's what's brought the snowy owls down, is that they're in search of more food than they could find. And there's obviously been a population increase in their Arctic areas, and that's caused some of these birds to push south in the winter in hopes of finding better food source.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, the thing that's been so striking to me about it is how much that's been developed. I mean, there are a large number of apartment buildings and townhouses and that sort of thing, as if the natural habitat has been replaced. I was talking to a manager of one of the buildings, and she said she went up on the roof where there happens to be a swimming pool, and there were a half a dozen hawks perched on a railing up there, scared the heck out of her. And they seem to have persisted through the development that's gone through there. And that's not just a bunch of single-family dwellings. So,
yeah. What you describe sounds unusual to me. I've often commented when out birding and you see these developments with conservation-themed street names and stuff like that to name the kinds of plant or animal species that used to live there before they were so heavily developed. So the fact that they've persisted after development is interesting. But there are some species like red tails and Cooper's hawks that do manage to do okay in more urbanized areas. So Cooper's hawks seem to have benefited from people's bird feeders. They tend to hang around bird feeders and pick off the weaker passerines that happen to be near the feeders. So I can't say, like Tom, I don't know that specific area, so I can't say exactly what's going on, but that certainly sounds interesting.
Yeah, it sure does. John, thank you.
Well, it seems like it's mainly red tails that are there, and part of my question, I guess, is there any other area where hawks do congregate like that?
Well, there are quite a few areas probably around the state. One area in particular is the Buena Vista grasslands, which is up in Portage County, south of Stevens Point, and like the site you describe, which sounds like it's more open if they're red-tailed hawks, they're probably pretty good rodent populations in those areas. And they tend to be a great place for winter visitors like this, either the snowy owl or the rough-legged hawk, which both come south out of the Arctic.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, John. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about birds on this first day of 2015 with our two guests, Carl Schwartz and Tom Schultz, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, though, we're enjoying a great talk about winter birding in Wisconsin with our two guests, Carl Schwartz, former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, current editor of the Badger Birder, among other things. Tom Schultz, a well-known wildlife artist, and has served as field trip leader for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and served for several years as a member of the steering committee of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project. So great to have them here, and thank you so much for listening in on this first day of the year. You may have a question. Maybe you've got a photo. Let's talk about photos. You got a bird photo and maybe a question or comment associated with it, or maybe just a photo. You could post that on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post right there. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or, again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. And, Tom, I think you have... You may have seen a photo that was posted of a Carolina wren.
That was actually my photo, Larry.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh, it is your photo. Oh, my goodness.
Just taken a couple days ago here. We have been the fortunate host of a Carolina wren here in our yard. We first started to hear it and see it in early November. There was our a property adjacent to us, a mature wooded area, was partially logged this past summer. And so there are lots of branches and brush piles and things like that. And I think that's really ideal habitat for wrens and Carolina wrens in particular. And but since the weather has gotten colder, this wren has started to show up underneath our feeders or at the feeders. And we don't see it all day long. We see it periodically. I mean, we certainly see it every day, but it's hard to predict exactly when it's going to be present. But we've been offering mealworms, freeze-dried mealworms, and also suet, which seem to be a preference of the Carolina wren. It's a slightly larger wren than the house wren that a lot of people are familiar with. And
yeah,
I would say slightly more colorful. It's real buffy colored underneath and sort of rusty brown on the upper parts, and a white eyebrow stripe, which makes it an attractive bird. It tends to be a year-round resident where it occurs, and tough winters tend to push it back further south, but typically they've been occurring in small numbers in areas in southern Wisconsin.
Well, it's a wonderful photo that you got. Nice, close photo. It really is a pretty bird.
Very attractive and very spunky, too. They're fun to watch.
In addition to being a talented artist, Tom is a great photographer, and that's really a wonderful photo of a really interesting bird to have coming to your feeders.
Absolutely. And just below the photo that Tom sent, we have a photo from Carol, who I think has four of the seven turkeys that were visiting my home, because maybe there were eight strolling up the sidewalk, she says, and she got a really nice photo of four of the eight. And they're she's on the east side, apparently, so I'm sure they're probably the same turkeys. But anyways, a nice photo of them as well. Jennifer in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I am in Milwaukee, where we have a lot of residential houses near Wauwatosa, so that's the setting. And I'm looking at my bird feeders now. We've had a Niger thistle feeder and have drawn lots and lots of beautiful goldfinches and decided we'd like to attract some other winter birds. So this is a shepherd's crook where you can put two of your tubular feeders on the same shepherd's crook.
Yep.
So we bought some sunflower chips, hoping to attract cardinals and juncos. And so our new feeder is right, you know, maybe less than 2 feet from the Niger thistle feeder. We're not getting any other birds. So now our beautiful goldfinches are enjoying the Niger thistle seed along with the sunflower chips and what was called the premier mix. So it's all hullless and a lot of sunflower chips. And our goldfinches are getting nice and fat, but in the meantime, we're wondering, should we just not have those two feeders so close together? How can we attract other winter birds in our urban yard?
Okay, who wants to take? Carl, you want to try that?
Well, yeah, I'll start. With any feeder, there's a break-in period. When you put out a new feeder or new feed, it takes a while for birds to realize it's there. And I've talked to a lot of people over the years who found out that sometimes it just takes a while for birds to show up. Juncos like to feed on a flat surface, so if you want juncos, better if you have some sort of like a little flat platform feeder.
Okay.
The juncos in my yard feed mostly on the ground, picking up the whatever everybody else spills more than anything else, and I don't usually put out something specifically for them, but they get
plenty anyway.
Yeah, they seem to feed on that. But what you're putting out is good for a lot of for chickadees and cardinals and nuthatches, woodpeckers and all. I always encourage people to put out suet. Suet provides a particularly rich nutrition during the winter. And is also, particularly if you use real suet from the butcher, its odor will attract things more quickly too. I tend to use these suet packs that you can pick up at a bird store or a hardware store or something like that, but they seem to work pretty well too.
Right.
Okay.
Great, so thanks, Jim.
The cedars are not too close together then.
I have the same sort of arrangement you do, and
okay.
It doesn't.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be as many cardinals in Milwaukee. We walk a lot in our neighborhood, and we haven't seen a cardinal in months, probably. So, has anybody heard anything? Are there fewer cardinals around? And is there anything we can do to attract them, or just have to wait?
I like safflower seed. Cardinals particularly like safflower, so that's one thing I feed to try and attract them. Tom, what's your experience on Christmas counts with cardinals? Mine is sort of mixed.
Tom, we lost Tom for just a minute.
Oh, well, okay, and I've got one
connected.
He's back now.
Tom, what's your experience been on Christmas counts with cardinals this year?
I guess I'd have to say that I've been seeing fewer on the counts I participated in. We have a fair number at our feeders here, but it may be due to the cold weather and possibly the lack of snow cover also that they're just more difficult to find. They're not pushed to the roadsides as much this year.
Yeah, I've had the same sort of experience with one notable exception. I did the Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee Christmas count. And we were out about at 80th and Burleigh, and there was a weedy yard that hadn't been raked, lots of leaf litter around, lots of overgrown bushes, and we stopped because we could see a couple of cardinals feeding in the yard, and so we just parked there and started pishing, you know, making a little psh, 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 sound to attract more birds, and before we were done, within about 5 minutes, we had counted 20 cardinals on this 40-foot lot.
Oh.
There wasn't even a bird feeder around, but there was just this, you know, great habitat for cardinals. It was brushy and sort of overgrown, and you know, not what you would call an attractive lot, but wonderful for birds. And I think people sometimes forget that sometimes you can make your yard too neat and too clean, and leaving some dense bushes and leaving that leaf litter and having lots of plantings, and particularly native type plantings, just it does a lot more to encourage birds to favor your yards than having everything immaculately trimmed.
And how can one get involved in that Milwaukee Christmas count? Is there a website for a association for that?
If you go to the WSO website, wsobirds.org, wsobirds.org, there is a Christmas bird count page on that website, and there's a link there to the map of all the counts in the state. And there were over 100 Christmas counts in the state this year, and you can look at the map and you can click on the whatever location, and it will bring up the information for the what they call the compiler, the person who organizes that specific count. Milwaukee's count is organized by a woman by the name of Andrea Zimzak, and that count's been done for this year, but you can contact her, you can email her, or give her a call, and I'm sure she would love to have you volunteer for next year.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post photos or questions there. I see now I went to, on our Facebook page, if you go to the left side of the page where it says Posts to Page, click on that. There are a couple of neat photos, one of a hooded merganser Denise sent. And let's see, there's another one here. Deb sent one and just said, just a little shout-out for the Heckrot Wetland Reserve. And then she's got a picture. And their little red resident, a little owl.
Yeah, that's a red morph screech owl. That's interesting. It's a pretty picture.
That really is a pretty picture. So
Heck Road is a really nice, that's up near Appleton. I'm not sure which of those Fox cities it's in, but north, in the Appleton area.
Yeah, it's really, really, really nice picture. We had Facebook, Brandon wrote and said roughly 25 years ago when I was somewhere between the ages of 6 and 10, let's say 8 years old, I was in the woods by the creek at my mom's house and almost walked into a bird about as tall as myself. Not sure what it was. I like to think it was a sandhill, which would make sense considering it was in Sandburg City. So it could have been maybe a sandhill. It could have been what else could it have been? It was near water, so.
Great blue heron. Yeah. The other obvious choice, yeah.
That's the other obvious choice. So, Brandon, you may well have had a sandhill, but it could have also been a great blue. Linda was reading the article about the ivory-billed woodpecker. Do either of you believe one still exists?
Boy, that's a question, Larry. And you see broad division between various bird watchers on whether they think the ivory-billed woodpecker is still in existence. There were some intriguing reports a few years ago down in Arkansas, but unfortunately not a lot of evidence. It's
right.
The challenge is that it's an extremely difficult type of habitat to access. It's wooded swampland, and this mosquito infested, and just it's very difficult to traverse and easy to get lost in.
Right.
And many of us suspect also that we know that woodpeckers tend to be wary and they tend to hide on the backsides of trees, and probably if there are any ivory-billed woodpeckers remaining, that they're especially they survive because of their secretiveness, and so they're going to be very difficult to try to get photos of. And I don't know what to say personally. I like to think that there might be still a few around, but my better judgment, I guess, tells me that it's not likely. It's been a long time since there've been any verified sightings.
Yeah,
and I would only second what Tom said. I think that's a perfect way of summing it up. We can remain hopeful, but we just destroyed too much of its habitat. There wasn't much habitat left, and it's one of those birds that's probably gone.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I'm fortunate in that I have a full-size wood carving of an ivory-billed woodpecker that Bob Googie did.
Oh, wow.
And I also have a pileated one that Bob did as well, carved as well. And they actually are, they look a lot alike in many ways, the pileated and the ivory-billed.
Yeah, they certainly do. And that's been some of the discussion, is whether somebody could have, with a brief glimpse, could they have mistaken one for the other? But really hard to know.
Yeah.
Really, really hard to know. So I've been surprised we haven't gotten anybody calling in to ask about New Year's resolutions or what sort of New Year's resolutions people could make as birders. And if anybody wants to, I'll toss out a couple of New Year's resolutions for callers to think about.
All right, Carl, give us a couple.
Well, the two that I have made personally, which I think are good ones, is one to be more faithful in my e-birding, to take advantage of the e-bird system to record my bird observations. That's one of the things. I just got back from this bird hike, but as soon as we're done with the show, I'm going to record the birds we saw today in Port Washington Harbor and up in the Sheboygan Harbor and Coller Andre State Park. And eBird is a way for people to not only keep track of their personal lists, but it's a way to commit a little science and to help in a very systematized way record what's out there. To do that, Christmas counts are being compiled on eBird, and my other resolution is to take advantage of the fact that Wisconsin is launching. You mentioned Tom's role on the steering committee for the upcoming second Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. The atlas is being launched. Well, I guess today, 2015 is the first year of the second Breeding Bird Atlas, and the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology is devising a eBird application for us to record the data from our Breeding Bird Atlas. And my second resolution is to take part in the next atlas, and to do that. What I would encourage listeners to do is to think about how they can participate in the Atlas effort, and if they want to find out more about the Atlas, they should come join us at the end of February for a 2-day conference and workshop on the Breeding Bird Atlas, and they can go to the WSOBirds.org website and click on the Atlas link there, and they can sign up. Registration fees only $10, and we'll feed you and entertain you and train you for 2 days, and you should have a good time, and you can commit some important scientific work and have a wonderful time learning more and finding more of the breeding birds of Wisconsin over the next 5 years.
So, oh, that's wonderful.
It's a five-year project, so it'll keep a lot of us busy for a long time. I think last time, 20 years ago, in the first Atlas, which your longtime participant in this show, Noel Cutright, engineered, 20 years ago, I think they recruited something like 1,600 volunteers who participated as atlasers, field counters for the atlas. So, a good project to think about as we launched 2015.
I like that idea. It's a great New Year's a couple of great New Year's resolutions from Carl Schwartz. Tom Schultz with us as well. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, talking birds on this first day of the year with Carl Schwartz, who is the editor of Badger Birder, the Society's Wisconsin Society for Ornithology's monthly newsletter. He also serves on the Great Wisconsin Birdathon Committee of the Natural Resources Foundation, among other things. Tom Schultz, well-known wildlife artist, he's illustrated many field guides to birds and has served as the field trip leader for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and for several years served as a member of the steering committee of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project. So great to have them both with us. You can join us. We've gotten some more cool photos on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And if you have a photo you want to post, I hope you'll do it. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can post there. You can also call us with questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. The most recent photos I believe we have up right now are from listeners are, let's see, we've got a pileated and also a Cooper's hawk. Guys, and I don't know if you're on the Facebook page right now, but
yes, yeah, I'm looking at the photos currently. Beautiful shots.
Yeah. Indeed.
Yep, absolutely. We had an email from Edward who said I've observed over the past 2 or 3 years an occasional pileated woodpecker in my area, northern Waukesha County. Are there numbers on the increase, or are they just extending their range a little bit? And again, that's probably something you could get some good information from eBird.
Right, and I think that's one of the things that the Atlas is designed to do too.
Yes,
that's specifically what it's trying to do is to find out what the range for breeding birds in the state are. I think pileateds are on the increase. I'm seeing them in areas where I didn't used to see them. So I'm hopeful that one will eventually show up in my yard. I know that I've seen them within 2 miles of where I live in Bayside, Wisconsin. I'm just south of there in Fox Point, and I'm hoping that one of those birds will move down the lakefront a little bit and show up in my yard someday.
Yeah. And, you know, we were talking about cardinals earlier, and it was a Facebook comment from Jenny who said, we have tons of cardinals out here in Wales, Wisconsin. I counted 14 at the feeder at once.
Wow.
On one day last week. We feed black oil sunflower seed year-round. We're also located close to the Kettle Moraine Forest. So, man, to have 14 on your feeder at once.
That can be sensory overload when you see all of them at one time.
Tom, are cardinals like chickadees, that they sort of they tend to flock up a little bit in the wintertime?
That's been my experience, Carl. I was enjoying your description of the cardinal flock you encountered, and I've had the same experience myself out birding or doing Christmas counts and coming upon a sheltered area, and you start pishing, as you described, and or just wandering through, and all of a sudden you might have 10, 15, 20 cardinals or more in one small area.
Right. I've heard that from a number of people, and they're specifically, chickadees are known to, that's a known behavior, is that they form what are called, foraging flocks in the winter, and they will often have mixed species foraging flocks. I mean, when people are out doing Christmas counts, they'll pish like that, because chickadees are particularly susceptible to coming into pishing, but they'll oftentimes bring in a bunch of other things with them, and you'll be able to you'll attract nuthatches and cardinals and woodpeckers and everything else that's in the area. And oftentimes those birds are feeding together, and you'll find some winter rarities like ruby-crowned kinglet sometimes, and golden-crowned kinglet, and titmice, and a few other things like that.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Glenda, and then we'll go to Susan after Glenda, but let's go to Glenda right now. Glenda, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Hi. Happy New Year, Birdmen.
Happy New Year to you too, as well.
Okay. I live out in Alden, Illinois, which is like close to the Wisconsin border, a little bit east of Harvard, and we're surrounded by about 1,000 acres of McHenry County Conservation. And I recently inherited my mom's little Yorkie, and he's about 7 pounds, and he loves to go out there and just, like, mark everything and smell everything and go everywhere, even at night. And, I guess my question is, how common is it, or is it at all common, for hawks or owls or things like that to nab, like a small dog?
Well, I'd have to say that it's pretty uncommon. It probably does happen at times. I know occasionally cats are taken by a bird like a great horned owl.
Uh-huh.
But it probably...
I know we have owls, and we have, I do feed the woodpeckers. They come in for the suet, and we have to be careful how much we do feed the birds, unfortunately, because we end up getting mice, also, there's a lot of cats in our building complexes, and
I'd be more worried about coyotes than I would be about large raptors. As Tom says, it's uncommon, but it does happen. Okay. I had a similar question put to me by somebody the other day who has a four or 5 pound miniature dachshund that he lets run loose out in a field near where he has an airplane hangar, and he's seen large raptors in the area, and he worries. And I said, yeah, I'd be worried. I mean, I'd think twice about doing it. Particularly at
the
night,
coyotes.
I'd be more worried about coyotes than anything else.
Yeah.
I live in an area that I know has coyotes, because I hear them howl And I know a couple of people whose cats have turned up missing.
So there you go.
I have my suspicions about that. And if I can use the opportunity to climb on my soapbox for a minute, one more good reason why people should keep their cats indoors.
Yep.
Cats are a terrible non-native predator on bird populations in the United States, and birds have not learned to adapt to them. And besides that, our cats live longer and stay healthier and don't get run over or eaten or anything else if you keep them indoors. So.
Yep, there you go.
Yeah.
Glenda, thank you. Appreciate the call. I want to give Susan in Milwaukee a chance to join us, who's also been waiting a long time. Susan, hi.
Hi, how are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I just wanted to let you know that in the evening on Christmas Day, my daughter and I were driving back from Manitowoc, and we were just south of Manitowoc, and there was a stand of trees there. And I saw a bird that I've never seen before in my life, and it was a red-tailed hawk. And it was just incredibly beautiful. And I just wonder, how come I've never seen them? And I've been watching for birds for, like, the last few years. I've been really into birds. And so
wow.
I'll take my answer off the line.
Yeah, I'm surprised, especially if, Susan, if you even just drive along the interstate, for example. It's pretty, I'm trying to remember a time when I didn't see one driving between Milwaukee and Madison, for example.
I think that's a case where, as she says, she's recently become more interested in birds, and I think we see more of what we're interested in. And I think once you become more aware of things, you learn how to look and where to look, and you're more likely to find them. I think that might be the explanation for that. But because you're right, Larry, they are certainly fairly common on the roadsides these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also I did see a snowy white owl a year ago over on the river in Milwaukee, right off of Capitol Drive.
Oh,
wonderful.
Yeah, beautiful. It was so
certainly
huge.
Around
I
this.
I couldn't believe how big it was.
Yeah, yeah, and that's Ryan Brady's post this morning made the point that you know, last year was such a huge eruption year for snowy owls, and everybody thought it was, you know, likely to be unduplicated for a while. And here we are following another year in which we've actually had more snowy owls reported in Wisconsin this year than last year. So it's a great opportunity for people if they want to see a snowy owl to have the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I appreciate it, and I appreciate your waiting so long. It was a long time. And you can join in. You won't have to wait too long at 1-800-642-1234. Chris coming up from Milwaukee, but then there's a line open for you. Again, 1-800-642-1234. Tom or Carl, were you going to comment?
Well, I was just going to make a brief comment. We were talking about cardinals before,
yeah.
And maybe a lot of people don't realize that the cardinal was actually a fairly uncommon or rare bird, the turn of the century back, when we turned to 1900, I should clarify the century, but they've gradually extended their way northward. They're a year-round resident, but they tend to be, hold out in areas where they can survive the winter, and I think a lot of their survivability has been due to the fact that more people are feeding birds now.
Yep.
And so they can survive through the winter and then remain to breed the following year. And really the same thing has been true for red-bellied woodpeckers also, which are now all the way up into northern Wisconsin, probably not nearly the numbers that we get in southern and central Wisconsin, but they definitely have expanded their range northward over the last 100 years.
Yeah, it's one of the most common woodpeckers I have at my feeder.
Yeah, and they filled in. I think you know. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, but they seem to have filled a niche that's been emptied as the red-headed woodpecker population has declined so precipitously in the state due to a do a number of different factors, but red-bellied seem to have come in even more strongly as the red-headeds have faded from the scene.
Yeah, there we go.
I think that's true.
Yeah. And Chris, thanks again. Well, actually, Chris in Milwaukee, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm here.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi. Happy New Year to you all. My question regards sparrows in bushes. When we're walking in the neighborhood and pass by a bush, we can hear maybe dozens of sparrows chattering away. And I'm wondering if in this convocation they listen to one another or if it's just a chatter fest.
and you know how when you get right next to them, how they'll all stop on a dime? They'll all be right. Chattering and then they'll all be stopping. You know what? We are actually going to take a look at the news. So I think we're going to hold that, Chris. We're going to hold that question, and I'm going to let Carl and Tom think about it a little bit and ponder it. And when we come back from the news, they'll have an answer for you. Carl Schwartz and Tom Schultz, our guests. You can join in. Open lines at 1-800-642-1234. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Well, whether we know almost nothing about them or maybe studied them our whole lives, birds are really fascinating. They add a lot to our enjoyment of Wisconsin's great natural areas, not just by seeing them, but by their wonderful songs as well. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network, and lucky, really lucky to have two great birding guests with us today to help us know what we're seeing and hearing. Tom Schultz, a well-known wildlife artist. He's illustrated several field guides to birds, served as a field trip leader for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and for several years as a member of the steering committee of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project, lives in Green Lake. And Tom, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Larry.
Really
great
appreciate it.
Great way to celebrate this first day of 2015.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Carl Schwartz with us as well. Carl's former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, editor of Badger Birder, the Society's monthly newsletter, serves on the great Wisconsin Birdathon Committee of the Natural Resources Foundation, and chairs the Steering Committee for Bird City, Wisconsin. Carl, great to talk with you as well.
Oh, glad to be here, Larry. This is a great way, as I said before, it's a great way to start the new year. Some great questions from your listeners, as usual, and just makes a fun day to start the year.
I totally agree. And we had a caller just before our news break who she and her husband will walk by a bush or something. There may be a whole bunch of sparrows in that bush, and they'll all be chirping. And she's wondering if they're actually listening to each other or if they're just out there having fun.
Well, I took you at your word and used your news timeout to do a little research to see if what I thought was right squared with what people have written scientifically about them. And yes, they do. In fact, I'm going to read you this one citation. House sparrows use a set of postures and behaviors to communicate with others of their species, but they also have a set of vocalizations that they use to attract mates, deter intruders, and warn others. And so I suspect when we're walking by them, when they're hiding in a bush, that's basically what they're saying is, watch out, something bigger than us is walking by, and we should be on the alert. And so I think our callers, Chris's instincts are correct that they are indeed talking to each other.
That's very cool. And they will like stop on a dime.
Right. Yep. And then I find this out on Christmas counts, because when you're doing your Christmas count, you're trying to get not only identify the species but numbers of a species. So when I hear house sparrows, I will start pishing, and pretty consistently they're curious and they want to know the enemy, and they will come out, they'll come flooding out of some of these these bushes and perch in a tree, and you got a much better chance of counting them than just guessing how many are hiding in the bush. And almost without exception, there are many, many more there than you might have guessed.
Yeah. Robert in Clark County, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Yeah. I was telling your producer that the other day my wife and I live up near Abbotsford, and we were driving down a back road by a big old open field, and we saw a snowy owl. And I had heard you guys talking before about how they'd all come down from Canada, and we watched it for, it had to be 5 minutes. It was just flying around, and it was beautiful. It was really neat.
Clark County.
Up off of 29 between Green Bay and Eau Claire.
Yep, I've taken that road, and I've actually seen a snowy owl up in that area last winter. There's some big open areas up there that are favored. I'm wondering if people are if they're prone to do a little research, because you can go online and read about a little bit these and actually figure out what the sex of the owl that you're seeing. The females, the larger owls tend to be females. Like a lot of raptors, the females are larger than the males. And the females also tend to be the darker ones, along with the immature. So if you see a large dark bird, a large dark snowy owl, it's likely to be a female, where the smaller, pure white ones tend to be the adult males.
Now, this bird was just snowy white, and it was just beautiful.
Yeah.
You hear about it, and you know, like I said, I've heard them talk about how they're coming down from Canada. We were, of course, we never stopped the thought to take a picture of it. We were so mesmerized by it.
Yeah.
But it was just beautiful. It really was.
Yeah, it's a treat. It's a special treat. I think an opportunity like this lets people really understand better why they. Why birds are so important to us, why we really connect with them.
Robert, thanks again for calling. I really appreciate it. And I want to give William in Middleton a chance to join in. William, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have two comments. There is a rare wild Finland pigeon in southern Finland that looks very like the once abundant but now extinct American passenger pigeon. You can answer that comment after I make the second comment.
Okay.
The other comment is that in 1930s through 60s, there were in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan thousands upon thousands of partridge, but now having become rather rare. The reason for partridge demise is not habitat loss, as the ICU nice gentleman always says, habitat, but rather that there are too many predators and raptors. That's my opinion. Thank you for allowing another point of view to be presented on this nice program.
All right. So there you go. A couple of different points that William brings up. The first was talking about a rare pigeon that looks kind of like the passenger pigeon.
I'm not personally familiar with that pigeon.
No, I don't,
in Finland.
Yeah, I don't know much about European pigeons. There's a number of different breeds over in the old country, but I have not studied them enough to know that. And I've forgotten there is a Tom. Do you remember what the close relative, the closest existing relative of the passenger pigeon is?
Scientists say it's the band-tailed pigeon.
That's right. Yeah.
We think of the mourning dove as looking more like the passenger pigeon than the band-tailed pigeon, but right. in studies and considerations of possible cloning to try to recreate a living passenger pigeon, that's the species that's most often mentioned as a suitable host.
Mm. I've heard Stan Temple talk about that, and I couldn't remember off the top of my head what it was. As for the caller's second point,
and that had to do with the partridge, and he feels that the reason that there's there are fewer of them is not habitat loss, but the number of raptors.
I would just respectfully disagree from everything I've read. It's more what we've done to the landscape in terms of our farming practices than anything else.
All right. Tom, you're in agreement with that?
I would say so. Maybe there's some truth in the fact that some of the forest habitats of the grouse, the rough grouse, have become more fragmented, thereby allowing perhaps some raptors to be more successful in finding grouse. So that might have some influence. But I know that some of the locations where I was finding grouse 20 and 30 years ago are now vacant of them, and there may be a number of reasons why, but they're definitely a fewer number.
And see, I thought he was talking about gray partridge, and that species, which is more of a grassland. I think of it as more of a grassland bird, and I think of, you know, locally Ozaukee County, which used to have a lot of gray partridge, but doesn't have them so much anymore because, you know, everything's been in pretty much, you know, plowed up for corn and soybeans and everything, and not left in the more open grassland sorts of things that partridge would favor.
Yeah.
Well, if the caller's still there, maybe you could clarify what she was speaking about.
I'm here. I'm here.
Were you talking about rough grouse or the gray partridge?
Yeah, rough grouse, the northern grouse. Grouse that are up in the northern part of the state. When I was young, always young kids, you know, we'd go out in the woods and you'd be sitting up in our limbs. You know, it'd be fun to just see them all over. But now the partridge you see, they're down on the ground because they, evolution, selection pressure, whatever, the ones that roosted up in the trees, they were got by the hawks.
Well, there you go.
The northern raptor that would be most likely to take rough grouse are northern goshawks, and their numbers are in decline, and they're really really very very scarce up north. So I'm not sure what raptor would be eating the grouse most likely. So.
All right, there you go, William. Thank you for calling. I want to give Bill in Madison a chance to join us. Hey, Bill.
Good morning, Larry, and thank you for putting on this wonderful show. One of your guests, I'm not sure if it was Tom or Carl, fielded a question about red-bellied woodpeckers and their populations increasing. I grew up east of Portage in Oaken farm country, and we had lots and lots of those beautiful red-headed woodpeckers, and they're pretty much gone now. And I had thought that the reason for the decline in the red-headed woodpeckers had to do with habitat loss. And it doesn't make sense to me that red bellies would increase their population to use habitat formerly occupied by red-headed woodpeckers if the problem that took away the redheads was the habitat loss. Are there other explanations for the loss of red-headed woodpeckers other than loss of habitat?
What do you guys think, Carl? You want to start?
Well, there are a couple of things. The redheaded tended to like the oak savannas, which are one of the scarcer habitats. Now, there's also been some research about the way redheads are more prone to colliding with vehicles than other species. Bill Miller, who heads the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory, did his master's thesis on that very issue. They also seem to have been displaced to a great degree by starlings, taking over their nesting cavities. And I think red-bellieds just in general seem to be more adaptive, more generalists. I'm on the edge of my knowledge base here, I will have to confess, but I think red bellies have just proved to be more adaptive. They say in the most successful species are the generalists, the ones who can who can adapt to all sorts of habitats and food. And, you know, that's why we have all these starlings and house sparrows, and, you know, because they can persevere through all sorts of bad things. So, Tom, you started that conversation earlier. I don't know about red-bellied. What do you think here?
Well, I tend to agree that they're probably just overlap in their habitats, and there are other factors for the decline of the red-headed woodpecker, and some of which we probably aren't even aware of.
Yeah.
But I think they're primarily ground-feeding birds, and perhaps they pick up more pesticides from insects. It's hard to know for sure what all the factors are, but definitely starlings have contributed to, and house sparrows also, to a decline in cavity nesting birds, just because they tend to be aggressive. Just last year, I was watching a pair of red-bellied woodpeckers that were trying to defend their nest from a pair of starlings, and the female red belly in particular was right up close to the starlings at the nest hole, and the male was up there kind of lending moral support. He was calling excitedly, but he wasn't really aggressively chasing like the female was. But it appeared to me that the starlings were taking over that nice nest site.
There we go.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bill, for calling. Appreciate it. And we have a nice photo up on our Facebook page. Oh, and a video as well of a pileated at a suet feeder. And a three-toed woodpecker as well. So this is over on the left side of our Facebook page. If you go to posts to page, I believe that's where they are located. So click on that and you'll actually see a video of a pileated at a suet feeder. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I would mention to listeners that I took the liberty of posting to that page a link to the information on the Breeding Bird Atlas kickoff meeting. So if anybody wants an easy way to find that information, they can go to your Facebook page and look at those posts, the page, and there's one there for me that has that link.
Very cool. We've got Dean in Cedarburg next. Hi, Dean. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. It was this last fall, probably like early October, I was riding north on the interurban trail in Ozaukee County, and it was probably like within a half hour of sunset, and there was kind of like just grass on the right side of the trail and bushes on the left side, and all of a sudden a red-tailed hawk passed me and swooped down to go after a rabbit that was running along by the bushes. It unfortunately missed the rabbit, but it came very close to hitting me.
Wow.
That can give you a real start. Rabbits are pretty big prey for a red-tailed hawk. They will do that, but they tend to favor meadow voles and things like that more often. If you see them on the wire eating, they usually have something like a big mouse as their favorite prey.
I did see a red tail flying with a very small, like almost a baby rabbit.
Yeah.
Wasn't happy.
Right. That's more their size of stuff. The young prey.
I mean, since it happened so long ago, it's possible that I remembered it wrong. It could have been a squirrel instead, but it was not anything small like a mouse.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. I've seen them. I have seen them take a squirrel. I live on a ravine, and you think of red tails more out in, on fields and stuff, but I've got a pair that fly right through the ravine, and I watched one take a squirrel right off a branch out in my ravine.
Pretty cool.
Dean, pretty exciting.
Yeah. Dean, thank you. Randy in Sauk County. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I wonder if any of you know if anything like what I'm going to tell you is still part of the school curriculum, maybe. When I was in the first grade, which is unfortunately in the late 1950s, I actually went to four grades were in one room, a country school. The teacher had this activity where she presented a mimeographed bird, and this went on for the year. Now, I don't remember many activities, but I remember this one well. And you had to, of course, color the bird, but you had to select the right color from your crayon set, and you had to have a nice set of crayons to do that. And then at the end of the week, we would recolor the bird, and the discussion during the week would be, had you seen one, and so on. And to this day, we have bird feeders, we have bird baths in our yard and enjoy. And I go back to that activity where I remember a bright brown feather next to a creamy colored feather. And some of those pictures would have in the talons the prey the bird had received. And I'm just wondering, does the school curriculum involve to this day? If not, I would suggest a nice activity would be to bring that back, because, boy, that changed my appreciation for things that fly around. And when I look at them, I look for those contrasting colors and things like that because of our first, second, third, and fourth grade teacher.
Oh, that's a great story. Tom, do you know anything about that?
Well, I hope there are a lot of teachers listening to that, because I think they can provide a great opportunity to start youngsters out on the track of learning more about birds, starting at an early age. And I do a fair number of presentations for school groups, especially elementary grades, and I've seen a wide variety of differences in the approaches between different teachers. And you know, I think it probably a lot has to do with their personal interests and experiences. But if the teacher is interested in birds and nature, they tend to feature that within their curriculum.
There is a curriculum out there now called Flying Wild, which is designed to help ensure that students are knowledgeable about the conservation needs of migratory and other birds. Flying Wild. And the Bird City, Wisconsin program encourages communities to use that program in their schools. And hundreds of different classrooms around the state are using that. There's going to be a training session coming up at the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative annual meeting coming up in March up in Chippewa Falls. So that's a wonderful opportunity.
Great. Very, very cool. And you know what? We are out of time, guys. I want to thank you both very, very much. This has been a wonderful show, and I'm certainly hoping we have a chance to do this again. Carl and Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Larry, as always.
Really, really, really appreciate it. Carl Schwartz, former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, editor of the Badger Birder, the Society's newsletter. Tom Schultz, a well-known wildlife artist, our guest today, and I certainly will have them back and we'll do this again. Tomorrow's Garden Talk, and we'll learn about growing great veggies. You stay with us.